have begun. Excellent. Thanks. Glenn, I know that we've done somewhat of an informal role, but if you would be so kind as to take one to see if anybody's joined in the last couple minutes, that would be great.
Certainly, Christina. We've got yourself on the line, Peter Olson, Lance Griffin, David Maher, Marty Millen, Avery Doria, and Andrew Mee.
All righty. Welcome, everyone. As you've probably noticed over the past couple days, I've been rather busy trying to make sure that we have documentation centralized to the extent possible. I know that I had put together, well, Mike had started and I had put together the kind of thematic chart based on a suggestion by Victoria a couple calls ago. I am inclined to say that at this point that unless someone feels very strongly about it, that perhaps what we might want to do is look instead at some of the proposals that have already been submitted and see if there are comments one way or the other, to the extent that we can identify, even if perhaps there's not a consensus as to an entire proposal, but there may be kind of consensus, at least among those on the call, as to parts of it, that we can distill those out so that we can really come down to nuggets that would be most useful. Okay, I'll take it that no one has any strong feelings one way or the other. Before we get started, does anyone have any additional ideas or suggestions that they have not previously made available on the list, but that they are, would now like to raise?
Sorry, Christina, may I just add that Liz Williams has joined the call and Victoria.
Okay. Hello, Victoria. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Christina. I just didn't break into the call. Sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. What I was saying is that I had prepared and sent around kind of a thematic set of tables based on the TLD summaries that have been completed to date, and to the extent that I knew about certain aspects for ones that had not been completed, I went ahead and filled those in. Having said that, given that we are really coming close to the end of our time, I thought that perhaps what we could do is instead focus on the proposals that have been submitted to date, and to the extent that we can, for example, in discussing each one briefly, identify perhaps components of them that are acceptable to everyone, if it's the case that, for example, there's no agreement on any one in its entirety, that we can then kind of distill these down into subcomponents that at least to the extent that we can say that there's consensus or agreement based on the participants, based on the number of participants, that we could reflect that at least tentatively. But before I did that, I wanted to see if anyone had any additional proposals that were ready to be discussed or that they wanted to discuss that they hadn't yet made available to everyone. All right. Peter, are you still on?
Yes.
Okay. Are you in a position to run through, and you can pick whichever component, part of your proposal you want to talk about in the time that you have. Do you want to go ahead and just get started in terms of just running through very quickly, summarily, because everyone hopefully got the document, and they've seen most of this before. Just what the kind of high points are of your proposal.
Sure. Yes, it's basically three parts. The first one was this outsourced sunrise. Instead of each new registry having to make their own sunrise, we outsource it once and for all to someone like ICANN or WIPO. The second thing was a possibility of defensive removals where domain names that would only be cyber squatted anyway would just be able to get permanently removed. And the last thing was a name string notification, which is it's a kind of opposition term for domain names. If they get a domain name application contains a trademark or a prior name, then the owner of the prior name could have the opportunity of putting it into a UDRP-like process, such that it wouldn't get registered first. And that's basically we were at last time we talked about this. I think we talked about mainly the first one of these, the outsourced Sunrise, and people thought it was a pretty good idea, as I remember. I think what we really need to talk about is the name string notification to see if there's kind of a general consensus on that as well.
All right, and I will kind of take that as a cue because I had added in the table that I submitted to the list about half an hour ago, I had put in kind of a variant of that proposal that really was kind of an amalgamation of certain features of the .biz IP claim process and the .name watch service. And in terms of, you know, to the extent that I've had a chance to kind of cross-check it against the proposal that Peter had put forward, it would be then, I mean, the kind of high, the changes, or at least the variances, seem to be, you know, to one extent timing, in the sense of under the proposal that I had put in, which was actually something that I had received from someone from someone outside the group, the domain name applicant, when there was a match, would be notified that there was a match and be provided with the basic information about the watched string basis. In other words, if ABC company had put in a string for, you know, 1, 2, 3 based on ownership of trademark registrations in this country, that country, and the other country, then the domain name applicant for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 would get a notification that it's ABC company, this is the right that they've claimed, this is the basis, do you want to go forward? And then it was only upon the applicant deciding to affirmatively go forward with the registration, in much the same way that the .biz IP claim process was set up, that the you would then have a situation where it would be necessary for the rights owner to actually initiate a challenge. I guess the other thing that I would note is that in the kind of second variant of the proposal in the chart, it would be a requirement that the whatever right the prior rights owner wanted to assert, in other words, if they wanted to watch a string of 1, 2, 3, they would need to have a prior validated right through this, you know, if we're going to go through the centralized database or whatnot, that you wouldn't really just be in a position where people could arbitrarily say, well, I'm interested to see what, you know, ABC company is doing, so I'm going to put a watch on all of, you know, its marks, that type of thing. It would really need to be tied back to the centralized validated right. The other kind of difference is kind of flipping a little bit the requirements for prevailing in a challenge, and you could have multiple rights owners watching the same string, and they could all object if they wanted to, and in that event it would be consolidated into one proceeding. The rights owner would bear, or multiple rights owners, the case may be, would bear the fee for, you know, the dispute resolution proceeding, with the caveat that the applicant would be required to post a small monetary bond, you know, something like $50, mainly to ensure that there is, in fact, kind of a true interest in using the domain name as opposed to just an automated process. In the event that the applicant prevailed, the outcome of the proceeding would really depend on satisfying those three factors in terms of the UDRP type factors. If the rights owner prevailed, the applicant would not register the name. It would not be the case that if the rights owner prevailed that they would be the registrant of the name. It would simply be a pure blocking mechanism. If the applicant prevailed, not only would they get their bond back, but they could go ahead and register the name, with the caveat that the fact that there had been this kind of initial proceeding would not have any preclusive effect in keeping them from later pursuing a UDRP if that's what they decided to do. in terms of, I think probably the only other thing that was kind of specifically added is that, you know, the proceedings would be very standardized and solely electronic in much the same way. I don't know to what extent people on the call are familiar with the .mobi Sunrise Challenge process, but it was kind of an electronic form. You know, you could cut and paste your Word text into it, but that was it, and you had very strict space limits, which frankly were not that difficult to stay within. So the idea would be that the process would be very streamlined. It would be very fast, particularly since the name would not resolve during the pendency of the challenge, in much the same way that, you know, .biz names that were the subject of startup opposition proceedings did not resolve.
Right, and I think the difference between this and the IP claims and the other startup kind of things is it's a permanent kind of thing.
Right,
it'll be there forever. So it's a new idea and a good one, I think, because if we can get consensus on this one, then it'll go far for making everybody happy.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
That's Margie. On the defensive removal concept, where, you know, I guess it would no longer be available for registration for anybody, or would, you know, it seems to me that might be a problem from a registry standpoint, because there might be other people with legitimate rights to use it. Just say United as an example, you know. If it gets blocked because a particular person doesn't have rights to it, but, you know, later on someone else does that mean that it's forever outside of, you know, unable to be registered? I guess that's my question.
Oh, no, there would be a challenge in there right from the start. It's not designed to take out those kind of things. It's designed to take out the pure cyber squatting domain names. Not common names or generic names.
I have this is Aubrey. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah, on that particular one, if let's say you don't challenge it at the beginning when the original, you know, getting their standing to have this service, to use this service, you don't challenge it then because you're just not awake and paying attention. Can it be challenged at any time and have that status removed? And how would that work? Let's say another, you know, someone else comes along who does have a righteous claim against them.
Well, it depends on, and I'm not entirely sure I understand your question, but basically there would be, for example, a 20-day period or a 30-day period within which anyone who participated in the watch service for this particular string could object.
Yeah, no,
if they decided not to object and allow the name to go forward, simply, you know, and it may be for the very reason that you suggest, that on its face it's hard to say whether the name is going to be used in bad faith or not, or was registered in bad faith. They could still do UDRP later.
That wasn't like the question I was asking, and perhaps my question doesn't make sense. It was there was an initial period where the person subscribing to any of these services, mm-hmm. either for the name removal or for the subscription service, needed to demonstrate their standing, and that could be challenged. What I'm asking is there a challenge against the person holding that privileged status of being able to, and of having standing for these services? Can someone standing for the services be challenged at any time in the future?
Yes. At any time in the future. There'd be no statute of limitations on that at all. And basically, they just have to prove that it would be like the opposite of a UDRP. And, you know, in the UDRP, they have to prove that there's a trademark right and that they have no legitimate interest and that there's bad faith registration and use. And if the person who wants to challenge this can prove any of these elements, then they can remove the removal, the defensive removal.
Okay.
Was that the question you were asking, Aubrey? Because yes, I actually thought you might be answering it, asking a different question.
No, that was actually the question I was asking.
Okay, all right.
Hi, this is Jeff Newman. I've been on for a couple minutes, just waiting for a chance to introduce myself.
Hi, Jeff. Given that we're kind of taking your .biz process, hopefully not in vain, do you have any questions or suggestions or comments?
I'm just listening.
Okay.
It should be, do you guys have any questions for me on how that worked? And
I actually do.
And I just have a brief one in that, and I have to say that now that I have plowed my way through all of the proof of concept reports, I want to thank you or whoever at your company that did yours, because it was by far the most helpful. There was 2 points that I had a question about, namely that I think there was a sentence in there to the effect of that in retrospect, that there was kind of a general recommendation that in the future that the claim should be bundled with a registration application.
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion that people who thought that they had filed a claim had also applied for the name. So there were a few trademark owners that missed the application part of it.
Oh, I see.
Because they thought by submitting the claim, they were also submitting a domain name application.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to do it again in the future, we would give it kind of, by filing a claim, you were also filing an application for the name, so you wouldn't have to apply again.
Oh, I see. Because if my recollection was correct, oh boy, and this is, I apologize, they're all starting to blur together. A successful stop challenger, were they awarded the name if they could prove that they were otherwise entitled to it?
Yes.
Okay.
But oftentimes there were a couple of names, believe it or not, where claims were filed but nobody filed an application. So it went into the general pool of names, and then someone else had registered it, and then they couldn't do stop, they had to do the normal UDRP.
Right.
Whereas they could have just solved the whole, they mistakenly believed that by filing a claim they also filed an application.
Right. Do you think, based on your experience, that if the process we're talking about were to separate them out in the sense that, you know, whereas under the .biz stop process, a successful challenger who could show they were eligible for it was awarded the .biz domain name, you know, in the process we're talking about, a successful challenger would not get the domain name, they just, no one would get the name, or the specific applicant actually wouldn't get the name. Do you think from that perspective, would that kind of lessen the potential confusion by not having the application and the claim bundled?
I think you're creating some other problems. I think you're not providing an incentive for challenges. In other words, there's a couple different alternatives you mentioned. If you're not awarded the name, and then it's just, or if it's just taken out of the pool, why would someone not want the name and just have it taken out of the pool? If they've gone through the trouble of filing a stop proceeding, I mean, or whatever you call it, why would they not want the name?
Well, they very well might, but it just seemed that it was easier and cleaner to keep it separate in terms of trying to come up with kind of baseline suggestions that would be least likely to encounter resistance. At least that was my feeling on it.
So you're giving the person who files the challenge an option of one of those three.
Right.
That's their option.
Right.
And you're not talking about doing anything up front as far as... Well, but you were talking about the watch notices, right?
I mean, right.
So essentially, you could give them a choice when they want to file the watch notice or whatever you call it. They could also count that as an application for a name.
Arguably, yes. And then the only thing that you would run into is if you had multiple people with watch services for the same string. And when I say string, I mean not necessarily mark. And then you would have to deal with it on the back end if you had multiple rights owners or however you want to define them, wanting to challenge the same name. You know, and I know, you know, .biz randomized those.
Yeah, and that was, yeah.
Okay.
And there's lottery laws and other things that you have to watch out for.
Right. I should note that perhaps the other thing that we could put in is that once the applicant in this kind of scenario with the watch service, if an applicant loses a challenge, they can note they're not eligible to apply for the name again, that it would basically pull them out of being a potential applicant. Because the idea, I think, was trying to deal with some of the really kind of obvious kind of cyber squatting type problems.
but do it in a way that was kind of fair and simultaneously without having trademark owners end up with more registrations than they actually can use.
So who would keep that information? The registrars would know ahead of time that that person can't register? I mean, that seems to me to be kind of a little unworkable.
Well, I mean, you know, that's something that is left open. I mean, maybe you could put it in a, you know, keep it to the extent you're going to have a centralized database for all the rights verification and validation information. You know, can I have the same?
And are you talking about a watch service that's not just initially up at the launch, but a watch service that continues?
Yes.
That's expensive. I have to be honest. I mean, that's something that, we just think about how much you pay Thompson & Thompson to monitor, right, if you're in the U.S. I mean, these are not cheap services.
Well, that's true, but given that the UDRP filing fee is $1,500 and that, you know, that I have yet, I think kind of the general consensus even on the Intelist serve is that you can't prepare a successful UDRP complaint for under $5,000. I mean, as long as it's under $6,500 per year per mark, it's still pretty, relatively speaking, cost-effective. I see your point, though. I mean, you know, and it wouldn't obviously be intended to displace the UDRP.
I mean, there's lots of things. As long as people are willing to pay, there's lots of things that done. But just don't want to set the expectation that that's kind of something that a registry could do for free or cheaply, or even $80 a name or $90, whatever the biz IP claim was.
So the model would allow for charging a fee for that watch service by the registry, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you know, you could do it on kind of a subscription basis in terms of, you know, you could do it on a kind of per mark basis or per TLD basis or, you know, annual basis. I mean, this might also be something that depending upon how you configured it, could be done centrally as well.
So Jeff, I mean, theoretically, a registry could figure out what that would cost and then, you know, charge an appropriate fee, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things that can be done, certainly for, yeah, it's just an expanded service of the IP claims, which we had thought about at one point, Biz had thought about doing. It is expensive and would require a pretty high demand, right, because you got to build the systems whether or not there's demand, and that's kind of taking a risk. But that's, I mean, it's not something if we're just talking about possible alternatives as opposed to mandating it on a registry, yeah, I'm sure there's ways that registries can figure this out.
I mean, I don't think at this point we're talking about, at least for this level of specificity, I mean, it was not my intention that we'd be talking about mandates. It would be more of, you know, a recommendation. I mean, there are other aspects of some of these things that, frankly, I had not gotten into the chart yet that I think could be, well, at least some of them I did actually, could be kind of baseline, you know, requirements. Namely, for example, you know, any right upon which a domain name applicant seeks to rely in a rights protection mechanism must be subject to some validation. Doesn't say by whom, doesn't say to what extent, but that it must be, you know, some validation.
So anyone, is that, that would be anybody who wants to watch a mark? Or that's just anyone who wants to enforce their rights?
Anybody who wants to participate in a rights protection mechanism, kind of defined broadly to include, you know, the defense of removals or an IP claim or Sunrise or, you know, any, whatever is developed and implemented, that anybody who wants to participate in one, you know, needs to basically, that right that they're claiming needs to have some validation.
I mean, you could separate it all out, right? A watch notice, you don't have to, if you just want to talk about a watch service,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to have a legitimate right in a mark to just have a pure watch service. You just want to know what's going on, right? It's like Thompson & Thompson doesn't have you if I wanted to search, or if I wanted to have a watch notice on anybody that registers any mark that has the letters NEU, because I'm Neustar, they don't validate that I have a, that I am Neustar, I am who I say I am. They just say okay, and they bill me.
Well, we would actually, in this process, at least in my, the second variation of it, they would require that you have a validated right.
Well, I'm just saying if you wanted to do something further and go to
sure.
the next step,
sure.
like you could separate the watch service out from the next step, which is having some ability to do something with that mark, either taking it out of the space or using it yourself, that part would require the authentication mechanism. But the first part of just having a straight-out watch service doesn't really matter.
Well, I think one of the concerns that, that came up in talking about this was the fact that in many cases, you know, a company will apply either directly or through an intermediary for a domain name in connection with a new brand launch, even before they filed their trademark applications, for example. And so that, you know, by requiring the watch service to be tied to a validated right, that you would basically prevent that type of possible bad faith use of that, that information.
Well, I'm just saying if you separated the watch service out completely from any other action,
yeah.
like it's just a pure watch service,
right?
It wouldn't matter. It doesn't matter who wants to search it, right? They pay the whatever fee it is to have a watch service, just like you do with Thompson & Thompson. It doesn't matter if they're authenticated. If you want to go to the next step and want to actually have some action, like, okay, you find out, hey, I'm Neustar, so I find out someone registers or wants to register my Neustar dot XYZ TLD.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and I want to take some action and prevent someone from registering it, assuming there was some sort of objection period, then to exercise that right, I would have to authenticate that I own it.
I don't disagree with you. I guess I'm just thinking that if in this process the name is not going to resolve until all challenges are, you know, filed and decided, that if you wait until that point to require the rights owner to have the right validated, that that would draw that out even longer. In fairness to the applicant, or you'd want to avoid that. In fairness to the applicant, but I mean, there's all kinds of ways for doing it. I guess the other question that, and maybe I just want to get back to this kind of centralized rights validation and database. I mean, for you know, of those on the call, I mean, is there anyone who objects to the idea of that?
Of having a centralized, can you go into that again? Sorry.
Yeah, I haven't. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry, it's Victoria. I haven't. Is this in your note?
It's in the most recent document that I've posted.
That came around just before the call.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Can we reserve our until we've had a good look at that?
Well, I'd actually like to kind of go through it simply because if there are ways that come out of this discussion that perhaps if we change this or we change that, we can have agreement on it to the extent that we can move forward with it, you know, I'd like to be able to do that. I'm happy to kind of run through now.
Okay, I'm sorry because I just can't really read and be on the call.
No. I was just going to describe it to you. And that essentially there would be a centralized rights validation process and database. Which could be designed and administered by ICANN, WIPO, some other designated entity with experience in this regard. Or arguably ICANN could put it out as an RFP and do it to a third party much the same way that Urid outsourced everything to PwC. Every rights holder that wanted to rely on a prior right and use a rights protection mechanism should be required to submit information about and documentation of its claimed rights for validation. Rights that had not been validated could not be relied on. The rights holders could theoretically designate the GTLD rights protection mechanisms that they wanted to participate in, and then the processor or database administrator, whatever that entity is, would then be responsible for, upon validation, relaying that data to the registry or registrar as appropriate. That further, the rights holders will be required to affirm on a regular basis, probably annually would make the most sense, the continued validity of each documented right. So in other words, if someone was relying on a U.S. principal register registration, that, you know, when they initially submitted it was between the 5th and 6th year for proving continued use of the mark, and the next anniversary came up, they would have to basically affirm that the U.S. registration was still valid. And, you know, arguably you could really set this up in much the same way that, for example, I get emails from Network Solutions and various registrars saying, you know, you need to confirm the validity of, you know, that your WHOIS data is complete and accurate. Participation fees could be levied on a subscription basis, with the relevant period kind of tied to whatever the affirmation obligation is. In other words, if you're going to do an annual obligation to affirm the validity, then you could have a, you know, it would only make sense to have a one-year subscription basis. In terms of calculating the fees, it could be based on the number of rights, the number that the rights owner wanted to have validated, the number of rights protection mechanisms in which it wanted to participate. You know, I guess there's a variety of different scales that you could do it. Another aspect of it would be to require the rights holders to whoever wanted to participate to create essentially a deposit account, similar to the types of accounts that, for example, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office use and that the WIPO International Bureau uses, against which the fees would be drawn. The advantage to doing it this way is that you can then allow for payment in mechanisms other than credit cards, to allow those participants who may be in economies where credit cards are not widely used can still participate by sending, for example, a wire transfer, a bank draft, or that type of thing. So that was really, I mean, the idea really is so that, you don't have rights owners having to kind of submit over and over and over and over the same documentation. Second, you have basically a way to ensure that there's some check on the continued validity of whatever rights the rights owner is claiming to have. Third, you avoid a situation where the registrars and registries are having to reinvent the wheel in terms of, you know, for example, if you did have a registry that would have planned to have a complete validation process, they don't have to do that anymore. That cost would be, you know, that would be kind of borne by the centralized registry, which of course would then pass it on, but it would avoid those kind of upfront costs that the registries would have. You know, similarly, you would have the registrars in a position where they wouldn't have to redesign, you know, each time there was a new TLD with a new type of mechanism and new types of requirements of rights, the registrars wouldn't have to design kind of new software or new interfaces to deal with that. I mean, the idea really is to kind of make this standardized and efficient and most cost-effective for everyone.
But you're only the centralized database. It wouldn't save costs for registries who want to validate something other than a trademark intellectual property right.
No, you could put in anything, whatever the registry decided would be kind of the scope of rights that it was going to allow as bases would then be submitted to the centralized database. So, for example, owners of literary titles, for example, could submit the documentation, the information sufficient to base a claim on their, you know, ownership of rights based on that title. And then it would just be a matter of the subset, the relevant subset or subsets of data being relayed to the registry as needed.
I guess I'm sorry. My point was that the registry wants to have a, for lack of a better term, a sponsored space that wouldn't help them with validating that kind of stuff. In other words, it had to be a legitimate travel association, not one who's got a IP right in a travel mark. But
right. It wasn't at least the initial intent of that, but I don't see why you couldn't have a parallel one, except for the fact that you would, you know, I can't imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, but I would think that you're really the sponsored TLDs that are going to have those type of eligibility restrictions and requirements are really going to be one off, I would think. So I don't know that it would necessarily be cost effective to put those into a centralized function. In other words, how many registries are you really going to have? where you would have to show, for example, that you're a member of one of the however many industries in the travel sector. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking aloud.
Can I just say, it seems like quite sensible, the idea of not reinventing the wheel every time, but the flip side of that is that there are probably competition concerns in the sense that there won't be, you know, this will be anti-competitive in terms of not encouraging competition between at least a number of providers, and therefore, you know, services may suffer and prices may rise, you know.
Would there be any structural reason why, and again, I'm going to, you know, I don't know enough about how you would set this up and how the data would need to be relayed, but would there be any reason why you couldn't have multiple authorized providers? Aside from the fact that everybody would need to kind of stay current with their data.
Is that, well, 'cause is that not what happens now? Or there's no accreditation process, is that what you're saying? I mean, there's no, everybody has to design their own.
Everybody has to decide their own. I mean, basically what I'm saying is that in much the same way that you have, I guess what I'm wondering, and this is the question I'm posing to the group, is, you know, is there any reason why you couldn't have a situation where you have multiple, you know, database administrators, and as long as they were all kind of communicating amongst themselves, you know, perhaps on a daily basis, make sure that everybody had a complete set of data.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I was
now, there's no way a PwC would establish a live connection to a, let's say, a KPMG or another entity that's able to do it. It's just, it won't happen. Same way that the UDRP UDRP providers aren't connected.
Right, but UDRP, there are several UDRP providers. I mean, so I was thinking you probably could do it if they all had to report, standardize their reports to, say, a registrar that the IP right, you know, exists.
Well, but you guys can tell me, the IP owners out there, but if you file a UDRP with the National Arbitration Forum and later file one with WIPO, to what extent does WIPO look at National Arbitration Forum's decision and coordinate? You know, it's my impression, because I've done it, that WIPO does its own fact-finding independent of what National Arbitration Forum may have found in another case.
Yeah, I think that's right, as long as there's some general standards that the providers would have to adhere to. They probably would have some leeway in how they do it. I'm just saying it's probably not impossible to have more than one provider, assuming there's a standard and there's a, you know, standard reporting mechanism to either the registry or the registrar.
Victoria, other than those concerns, and I don't mean to suggest that they're not important ones, but if the competition issues could be dealt with, what would your thoughts be on this?
Well, it sounds pretty sensible to me.
All right, so then maybe the question is to kind of deal with multiples.
This is Inja from WAP. I should just clarify for that on the UDRP side, when there is a decision rendered by NAF and we are made aware of it, then we certainly take it into account. That is, if we get a new UDRP case for the same domain and that has been already decided by NAF, then we would treat it exactly the same way as we would treat a UDRP decision decided by WIPO, and we would accept it only if certain conditions are met, certain refiling conditions are met. But it is true that if the complainant does not inform us that there has been a previous case, it is possible that we might go ahead unknowingly. But there is little information sharing, which I would admit it's not ideal.
Right. I mean, competitors for a particular service, even a UDRP service, are not going to communicate on a day-to-day basis and not develop some sort of interface amongst each other.
But I do think it's doable in the sense that in the beginning of the UDRP, all the cases were recorded by ICANN. I think the first 2 years, they were all recorded by ICANN, and therefore we could use ICANN's database to know which domain names were disputed before the other providers. It's just that ICANN has unfortunately discontinued that database, and therefore it makes it difficult for the providers to know to gather information about the cases before the other providers. But I think it is something that would be possible if it is intended.
The parties must surely bring that, at least one of the parties would bring that to the attention of the dispute resolution provider in practice, wouldn't they, though? You know, you've got to say at the beginning, I think, of these things, the decisions that I do, you've got to say at the beginning that nobody's aware of any other proceedings. So at least one of the parties is likely to inform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and in fact, you don't have the same kind of incentives to provider shop where you're talking about validation. If everybody's taking the same types of information to validate the same types of rates and applying the same standards, we just have different processors as opposed to kind of different standards, I think. I hope. I don't know if that just made sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can certainly see, as someone who has forum shopped myself when it comes to UDRP, you know, there are certainly, not in terms of multiples, but kind of just depending upon the facts, where to go, et cetera. But I don't think you're going to have those types of incentives. And in fact, I mean, Liz? John? Oh, well, maybe she'll join us. So it looks like, you know, if we can kind of tinker with this and assuming that it's workable, that this might be something that we have some consensus on.
But just to clarify, so this would be one layer and that each GTLD would have its own protection mechanism? Is that how it's envisaged?
Well, it could. It could. I mean, and that's one of the things that we haven't, you know, I think there, and maybe this is a good time to raise this, that, you know, that it's my understanding, based on previous calls, that there is consensus that you cannot have one single mechanism that applies in its entirety to all TLDs, just by virtue of how some of the TLDs will be intended and defined and sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
Is everybody in the call in agreement on that? And that was my understanding from previous calls, but it's an important point.
I think that was my understanding as well, that there was no consensus to a uniform mechanism across all TLDs.
Well, but this is somewhat different. I guess, you know, I know that there's no consensus as to which one, but this would go a little farther and say that, you know, there is consensus that it's just simply not possible.
Right.
Margie, Lance, Peter, Jeff, David?
Yeah, I agree.
All right.
Yeah, you and I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that there is not one mechanism that it should be mandatory across all GTLDs. I agree.
I go along with that.
Is that mechanism for validation or is that full stop? Sorry.
When I say mechanism, I'm talking about Sunrise versus IP claim versus, you know, watch service versus
something new that nobody's thought of.
Right. But in terms of, and I think this is what we had talked about a little bit before, that the other way to kind of, the other point within this is that although there is consensus that there is no one mechanism that should be applied or should be mandatory, and or it must be applied if we're going to do with the must, may, and I always get myself confused on that terminology. But what we also talked about is whether or not we could agree that within certain types of mechanisms that there were common features or common requirements that could be applied.
Well, I mean,
and I don't think we'd really explored that very much.
Okay.
And just to kind of give you an example, What I'm talking about is, for example, if the TLD elects to proceed with a, and this reminds me, we need to talk about definitions, but if the provider elects to proceed with a Sunrise type mechanism, these are the minimum requirements that it must have.
Okay, can I just jump in there for a second? I mean, I would have thought it's premature for us to be able to decide whether or not there's anything that might apply across the board, isn't it not? Is it not? I mean, what are we working on?
I would say kind of based on the summaries and the proof of concept reports, and just based on the fact that you've had, you know, for example, if you look at kind of the very tightly sponsored TLDs, where you need a specific ID just to even be eligible, and then you've got a restricted universe of names that you can pick from. I mean, I view that as a rights protection mechanism.
I mean, my view is that I would have said we haven't done the work, we haven't really, well, I certainly haven't done any real analysis as to commonality or applicability across, and I would have thought that we ought to have a look at that, you know, that ought to have proper and thorough analytical work done on it, because, of course, you know, just as your suggestion is such a good one for sort of standardizing the Sunrise process in some way, you know, obviously there's increase, you know, obviously there's got to be benefit to people for standardizing other aspects of the processes where they could be standardized. So we ought to be, but I don't know, I mean, I think that's just, it's kind of preemptive to say that.
Well, I think we're talking about different layers. Perhaps it might be the better way to say it.
All I'm saying is maybe, but maybe not. I mean, I'm just saying I certainly am and not clear about
all
that.
Right.
Christina, it's Liz here. I just have a question to raise with respect to that.
Sure.
I haven't heard any discussion about the results of the questionnaire that was going on, and I err on the side of caution and appreciate Victoria's view about this. It seems to me that I don't have, and I certainly wouldn't be comfortable writing a report that had recommendations about one size fits all or ways of doing things that apply to everybody, because I just don't think that work has been done. And I also didn't think, on the basis of reading the questionnaire results, that a one size fits all procedure was actually sensible.
All I'm saying is I haven't answered that question for myself. I haven't done that analysis. If everybody else has in the group has decided that that's fine, I'd just like to put my own marker down there that I'd like to think about that. But I'm just wondering, you know, have we really analysed the results of any of our work in that way sufficiently? If you feel that we have, that's absolutely fine.
Well, I don't think we have as kind of a group on a call. I mean, I know that I have gone through the summaries of the TLDs fairly closely, as well as the proof of concept reports, kind of with the caveat that, as well as the Summit Strategies report, with the big caveat that not all of the registries have proof of concept reports available on the ICANN site. So from in that context, it is my view that it is not possible, kind of independent of whether it's desirable, to choose one mechanism that all TLDs must apply. And when I say mechanism, I'm talking about kind of everybody's got to use an IP claim, or everybody's got to use a Sunrise, or everybody's got to use a defensive removal. That's when I say that, that's what I'm talking about.
And I think the supplementary point to that is that, Christina, if you look at the responses to the survey, the majority of people used an IP claim, which is a post-fact, not pre-registration mechanism,
right,
even though Sunrise mechanisms were offered in each of the TLDs that were surveyed. I'm just urging caution,
right,
on the part of the group to make sure that sufficient analysis has been done, and to make sure that we understand what we're trying to put together for a report, because from my side it's now becoming very critical that the writing of the report gets done very, very soon, but that it takes into account the inputs from the work that has been done with respect to the surveys, respect to the Summit Strategies report and other reports that have been done, and then also the questionnaire results.
how does everyone want to proceed? Because what we can do is kind of run through a list of things that we think it would be worth focusing on in the remainder of this call and our remaining calls, because we think we can come to consensus on them. Or in the alternative, we can just identify, you know, basically divide this up amongst ourselves as to, you know, who's responsible for coming up with various proposals pertaining to each type of mechanism. Or, you know, if somebody wants to take on the job of coming up with a series of possible definitions for some of these things. I mean, we can do this a number of ways. And I, you know, frankly have no preference as long as what everybody agrees to do does in fact get done. No one has a preference. All right. I guess one of the questions that I have, Liz, is I'm still kind of struggling with, you know, exactly how elaborate this report is supposed to be, simply because we can, you know, I can really kind of push and try and, you know, spend the next week, transaction aside, from, you know, into kind of putting together, you know, a huge chart that's got various iterations of various aspects of proposals that we can all talk about. But if that's really not what the council is intending to get from us, kind of above the baseline, you know, here's what's been done, here are the issues that precipitated these mechanisms, here's the issues they created, you know, a lot of this has already been done in Summit strategy, so we're not going to reinvent the wheel, but we're just going to refer you to that, and so on and so forth. You know, I guess whatever guidance you can provide from, you know, based on your experience in working on these types of reports, I would appreciate for one.
Well, let's go back a step. If the report has to go to the committee, the GNSO's committee, and they either accept or reject the advice of the working group, that's based on pretty much a vote structure. What can we get this group to get through to agree on as a report, whether it's 5 lines or 5,000? That's the practical question. So that's one question. And the second question is, let's adequately and sensibly reflect the statement of work, which is describe what's happened in the past, which are the summaries, and come up with a series of good ideas based on fact. So I would suggest that all of the materials that we referred to are useful in determining some top-line guidance for the committee about things that they could consider. It doesn't have to be elaborate or a dissertation, but it has to be something that is palatable to the broader committee.
Right.
And then, frankly, of course, palatable to the, I mean, the steps that we need to go through are then incorporating the work of the pro group into the new TLD's report, and then incorporating it into a board report that is part of an implementation plan. So mandating everything is not going to work. So being practical about what is a good suggestion about what could go forward is as much about politics as it is about survey results or anything else. So I'd suggest that we focus on a good summary, a good solid summary with all of the summaries included that have been done in all the existing registries. A very good top line analysis of the questionnaire, because that's been a major piece of work that we spent a lot of time dealing with, and judging by the responses and the response rates and who the responses have come from, people have been thoughtful and knowledgeable about how they've responded. And then I suggest that you come up with a plan that says, well, we consider that these questions are very detailed and they are worthy of more attention, and design a scope of work that the GNSO Council could perhaps consider for future work. Because frankly, this is a very, very, very tight time frame for very serious issues to be raised and then resolved, and I don't think it's practical.
All right. Well, why don't we do this? What I think, I have to think that everybody is on this call because this is an issue that they have opinions about. So, what I would suggest is, everybody between now and Monday, and I would like to have a call on Monday simply because I think we're going to need to, unless everybody wants to keep going right now, which I can do. I don't know if everybody can do. that they identify kind of the top 10 kind of general principles that they would want to see in any rights protection mechanism. The other thing, and then once we've got that, we can, and it may be that we're on more similar pages than we think. For example, just with the point that we talked about earlier, based on my review of all these materials, I can say that I personally do not believe that there's a one-size-fits-all mechanism. I can go from there. The other thing, I mean, is that something that everybody can do and is willing to do? Or in the alternative, has an idea that they think would be most helpful? Because the idea with that would be then we can consolidate those, and to the extent that, for example, we can find thematic agreement, even, and perhaps there might be opportunities for people to kind of say, okay, well, I can change my view on this, or if we go with more generalized language, then I could live with that, but I don't want to be as specific as this. Will everyone do that? Or does somebody want to suggest something else?
Sounds reasonable to me.
All right. I have another request. It would be extremely helpful, because these are things that we've kind of bandied about for a while. We still do not have a formal definitions, and Liz, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we do need to have them if we are going to talk about them.
Oh, absolutely. That has actually been a critical improvement in the working group materials that have been produced in the last couple of months, where the front page of the report says, these are the definitions, this is what we mean, this is what we're talking about.
Right. Can I ask for two people to work together on coming up with definitions? And it may be necessary to come up with multiple definitions of the relevant terms.
Depending on the context.
Right, depending upon the context.
Okay.
Can somebody agree to do that?
Yeah, I can do that. This is Margie.
All right.
And so what you're talking about is terms that seem to be used over and over again, right?
Right. That, for example, obviously I think we need to have a definition of, IP claim.
Right.
I think we need to have a definition of Sunrise. And to a large part, I mean, the definition that Jeff provided in connection with the questionnaire for IP claim, I think would be an excellent starting point kind of with the we may want to, for example, tinker with it a little to try and bring into, for example, the processes that .dk and .name used in terms of requiring kind of a confirmation or acknowledgement of rights. Or, maybe we want to split it up to cover that. So I think we need Sunrise, we need IP claim.
Offensive registrations is probably another one, right?
Yeah, especially since I've noticed that, for example, in .pro, exactly, because it seems to be that in some cases they're talking about blocking, and in some cases they're talking about removal, and in some instances it's used to define registrations, domain names that are registered for the sole purpose of preventing someone else from registering them. I mean,
right,
I've
right.
seen so many different meanings, and maybe we just need to come up with different terms for some of those.
Okay.
Any other... Do we need a definition of validation?
I was thinking the same thing, actually. Probably.
All right.
And, you guys on the list, even if you don't have a definition, if you think of words that should be defined, just post them, and I'll try to come up with a definition for them, because that'll give me, that'll help as well.
Yeah.
Aubrey?
We do need, validation, there was one concern, and I can't remember if I mentioned it or not, but needs to be considered. One of the issues with .us that we had is there not only needs to be a validation of the fact that the materials submitted are actually registered marks, but one problem that a registry has, as opposed to a trademark database, trademark databases do not maintain email addresses, which is very crucial because that's a key part to a domain name registration. There's no way to validate that the email address actually belongs to the entity claiming the IP right. So in other words, I could be John Smith. I could have John John Smith at Yahoo.com, but I could submit all this validating information about Coca-Cola, and the validator could say, yes, you know, the person who submitted, or could say that the stuff that was submitted does authenticate, but we could accidentally award the domain name to the person who's got the email address of John Smith at Yahoo.com. I'm not being very clear.
Yeah, no, actually, I understand what you're saying. You're talking about validating the registrant as well as validating the trademark and making sure the registrant and the trademark owner are the same.
Right. Now, in .us, we had a process that our decision was, if this had ever come up, and you know, knock on wood, it never came up, but the decision was that if someone had spoofed their information, that since we awarded the domain name based on the Coca-Cola registration, for example, that if someone from Coca-Cola wrote us a letter on their letterhead, who had authority at Coca-Cola saying that the person that was actually awarded the name was not someone at Coca-Cola, we would have given it to Coca-Cola, because since they're the ones that, you know, they got it on their behalf.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
Now I understand.
Yeah.
Avery, are there any terms that you think, you know, given your perspective and what you think, I don't want to say constituents because that's not the right word, but in your expertise, that have not been defined that you think we need to define?
Don't jump out at me at the moment, but I will take a look through and see. I mean, I have to think back to when I didn't know all these terms yet. So, yeah.
All right. And, of course, you know, everyone else should, too, but I know that, you know, in Victoria, the same would go for you with regard to the non-commercial users. You know, I want to make sure that...
I'll take a look.
Right. Okay. Liz, is there anything else that you would suggest that we do as a work item?
Well, that sounds fine.
Okay. Well, everyone, I very much appreciate it. I'm going to continue. Well, let me ask this. Do you think it's useful to continue to update this little proposals and comments chart, or should we wait until everybody's kind of posted their, you know, top 10 things I'd like to see comments?
I would kind of recommend that you wait until people that are going to contribute the 10 have had a day or so to do it.
Okay.
And then do an update.
Sure.
As opposed to putting yourself through doing two times. But I would recommend putting a time limit on us and then just assume that those of us that haven't done it aren't thinking about 10 things to put them.
All right. I don't even know what day it is. What day is it? It's Wednesday.
Yeah.
You laugh. It's just so sad. If we were to say, I mean, given that I would very much like to have a call on Monday at the same time, and I understand that, Liz, the line is available then. Is that right?
I'm looking at that now.
All right.
I have...
Sorry, I was just on speaker so I could use my computer and talk at the same time. I have a call at 9 on Mondays, at starting at 9. So a call at 8 running till 9 is hard for me. And I've got to get the utilities report prepared for another committee meeting. So it's possible to do it, but it's a big stretch on a Monday.
All right.
Given that, what else were you wanting to do prior to the 17th, which is the last call?
Well, what I was hoping to do was that basically all of the quote-unquote work would be done and things would be, you know, written far enough, that the writing would have progressed far enough so that basically what would happen between Monday and Wednesday is that the bits would be put together. And I don't necessarily mean by you, so that when we have on the 16th, that basically we're looking at kind of what is going to be the report, or at least, you know, it might not have all of the bells and whistles, but it'll have kind of the basic information that we intend to convey.
Yeah, I would have thought that's a sensible way to do it. So consider the draft report on the 14th and finalize it and agree it on the 17th.
Right.
So that between Monday and Thursday, there's, wait a minute. Wednesday, the 16th, at 8 o'clock, that there's the agreement on the call that the work can be finished.
Right.
The draft report considered on the 14th, and then agreement on the 16th that the last pieces
Right. Is there, and I apologize because I have a feeling you've circulated this, is there a framework or an outline or a structure that
yep.
you know, those of us that we should use?
Yeah, I've already sent that.
Okay.
Do you want me to send it again?
If you wouldn't mind, I think I don't know if it's the right thing.
Yeah, let me go back a step, though, because I did that specifically for the Reserve Names Working Group, and there were lots of subgroups. I'm not keen on lots of templates going all over the place. If the intention is to, for example, the PDF version of the summaries that you sent out yesterday is sufficient to satisfy the requirements of the first part of the statement of work with some text that says, these are the many different examples, this is what we did, this is how it was looked at, this is what's missing, these are our summary. And then the second part is that RPM document you sent out today, to satisfy the second part of it. So I would have thought that templates are not necessary,
okay.
but I can resend it for you
All right.
As the pen holder
All right.
To put that together if you wish.
All right, that would be great.
Okay, all right, I'll do that.
All right. All right. Does everybody's availability, I mean, to the extent that people are available Monday at the same time, is that availability change if we made the call 1 hour earlier? If we were to do that, would that work better for you?
No, because you'll have all kinds of extraordinary sound effects in the background.
All right, never mind.
From my family.
Okay, never mind. Okay, given that we're going to have a call on Monday, what would be a realistic deadline, both in terms of giving everyone time to do this, but also giving everybody time to reflect on it? I mean, I'm inclined to say kind of Friday at, 6 p.m. Eastern, or, Friday at close of business, wherever close of business is, depending upon where you are. I mean, is that realistic for everyone?
Are you talking about for the top 10 things?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that works.
All right. All right. Sooner would be better, but I think that would be kind of drop dead. So why don't we just say close of business on Friday, close of business kind of depending upon what your time zone is. All right?
Christina, I just had one more question.
Sure.
I don't know who's on the call. Would you mind just doing a reverse roll call so I know who's on the call? I'm sorry.
Okay,
Glenn, don't worry. It's all right. Fine.
All right. And I guess the other question that I had that would save me tons of time is there a mechanism by which we can easily extract or create a document that identifies the members as well as kind of who participated on each call? I mean, is that?
Yep, that's normal.
Okay. All right. Phew.
And that participation data is normally included now in all the reports.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't going to have to listen to kind of the beginning of every recording.
Yep.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you, everyone. I very much appreciate it. I'm much more optimistic that we're actually going to have something done. If you have any questions in the meantime, please don't hesitate to post them to the list. And to the extent that, any of you have particular experiences that may not be reflected in kind of your top points or that you feel particularly strongly about, I would encourage you to post them so that we can keep those in mind. All right? So thank you, everyone. Have a good afternoon, evening, or early day, depending upon where you are.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.